Greetings, growers from around the world. Jordan River here with more GrowCast. Today we have show favorite Dr. Coco back on the line. Today we are talking about coco and wet trim versus dry trim, and we get into a very spirited discussion about organic versus synthetic and end products or inorganic grows. And as I say in the episode, I just love it. I love that we can have this discussion and disagree on this subject and still remain close friends. And it's a great episode, and I know it makes for great pod, so you guys are going to absolutely love it. Before we jump into today's Coco episode, though, gotta shout out Delta Leaf Labs, deltaleaflabs.com. For the most affordable sex testing around, use promo code GROWCAST for free shipping on your tests. Stop wasting time growing out your plants, wasting space, sexing, looking at the plants. Is that a hermie? Am I seeing both? Is that a stipule or is that a hair? Whoa, what's going on? None of that. It's all cut out with Delta Leaf Labs. You just sex test. You pop off some cotyledons when they're super young. Like after the first true leaf set, you can get your plants sex tested, pitch the males, keep the females, whichever ones are most vigorous, keep those. And now you're rocking within your plant count or whatever you're trying to do. Delta Leaf Labs. Maybe you're looking for males. DeltaLeafLabs.com. Promo code GROWCAST. Like I said, stop second guessing. Stop wasting time and space. I am a big fan of the multi-plant in the pot trick, but it's just way easier and better to go with Delta Leaf Labs. I'm doing it every time for my photos, 100%. So DeltaLeafLabs.com, promo code GROWCAST for free shipping. All right, everybody, let's get into the show with Dr. Coco. Enjoy the program. Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to GROWCAST. I'm your host, Jordan River, and I want to thank you for tuning in today. Before we get started, I urge you to share GrowCast, spread the show. I say it all the time, but I really mean it. It helps us grow, and it's a tremendous way that you can help us out here. So I appreciate that, sharing the show. Today, we have show favorite Dr. Coco back on the line. What's up, Dr. Coco?
Hey, Jordan. Nice to be back with you.
Yeah, buddy. Appreciate you dropping in. We got questions always for Dr. Coco. We talk about grow science, if you will. I will categorize it in that genre of content. And today we are discussing coco, of course. We're discussing trimming, and we're going to go down a lot of different tangential paths, I am sure. So, Dr. Coco, can we jump right into a listener question? I mean, well, first of all, do you have any updates for us? Obviously, the Grow Challenge. Everybody join the New Year's Grow Challenge. Any other updates?
Yeah. We got the New Year's Grow Challenge coming up. I think that's the biggest news. We got it going on over at Coco for Cannabis right now. We're wrapping up our plant training grow challenge. And I actually have a meeting with the steering committee tomorrow to determine our end of grow prizes for that. We're giving away a MyGrow array, a couple of Vipar Spectra fixtures, and an AC Infinity fan to the best grow me and the best journal and the best recovery. And the best party cup plant. The party cup plants were a lot of fun in the plant training grow challenge.
Are you doing that again? Is there another side challenge?
We are doing a one cola challenge.
Oh, that's what it is. Nice.
The New Year's grow challenge.
Yeah, that's dope.
So the New Year's grow challenge, of course, starts January 1st. It's free to everybody to sign up. Go to cocoforcannabis.com/challenge. We're going to have a big giveaway on January 1st. And then we have monthly giveaways all throughout. I've got a really nice Photon Tech X Series light that we're going to give out at the beginning of February. We've got the Mars FC3000 and the MyGrow array and the AC Infinity fans. And
that's
all
a
sorts
good
of
lineup, dude.
Prizes. We already have about 300 people signed up for this. I'm expecting that to probably double before we actually get rolling on January 1st, taping this the beginning of December here. And it's going to be a whole lot of fun. So I hope everybody joins us with that.
I'll be there, buddy. I might be in the middle of my shit, but I'll be there and I'll be posting.
There we go. I am just about harvesting. My plant training grow challenge is sitting in the dark now. My plants have been in the dark for, going on 30 hours at this point. At some point today, I have to go in there and kill them, hang them upside down. And
kill them? You put it like
them
that.
Apart. That was one of the questions we're going to talk about today. Man. So that'll be appropriate.
That was kind of a gruesome set of phrases, though.
It's
cut them apart
for me, man. I mean, it really is.
I see what you're saying.
I get so And I really empathize with all the new growers that are approaching their first harvest. Although some of them are just like, I want it now. I want it now. Can I cut it down yet? I want it now. Can I cut it down yet? I mean, a lot of them are deeply, deeply ambivalent about now having to murder the plants that they've been, obsessing over and nurturing and growing for months and loving. And it's like, okay, wait, are you really? I'm supposed to like chop it down? I mean, this seems like an incredible act of violence to exercise against one of your beloved
your best friends. Yeah, totally. You're absolutely right, man. That's hilarious. Now, I got to focus in on one thing, and I'm sure we've covered it before, so forgive me if you just listened to the other episode of Dr. Coco and heard this.
Yeah.
But you do the darkness period? You do the lights out just like me?
Yes.
A lot of people label that as bro science. Do you really think there's something to that?
Yeah, I pretty much label it as bro science.
I mean, too, that's what I'm always saying, but I do it anyways just because I kind of like it and because like it saves electricity.
This is like the atheist that prays when the ship is going down.
It's fuck like, yeah. I love it. I love it.
I've done it a lot and it's not causing any harm. I am totally confident
that
it's not causing any harm. And it is the thing, you know why I do it? I actually think at this point, it's almost the same reason that I flush, is it makes it like, okay, well, now I actually have to harvest. I mean, I can't just keep kicking the can at this point.
You use it as a committal. It's too funny, dude.
Yeah, it's an easier point to sort of commit to. It's like, okay, I'll just flip the switch. That's easier than like, busting out the PVC pipe cutters and taking it to the stem of your plant.
Oh, man, that's too funny.
And then once they've been in the dark for 30, 36 hours, I'm thinking like, okay, shit, I better go get them.
Yeah, it kind of does put you on a timer. That's a really good point. I got to admit, I think there's a little something to it. I think it helps it ripen maybe. I don't know. I like it. And I hope that one day we're vindicated by some study out there, some ambiguous study that confirms my confirmation bias, and then we'll be extra happy.
Yeah, all of these things that you do at the end of the crop cycle like that, I'm pretty sure that there's a chance that some of them could stress the plant into producing more cannabinoids or doing other things like that. I don't think you're going to stress the plant into suddenly like eliminating a lot of cannabinoids though. So I don't think that there's a huge downside. And yeah, there are reasons to think that some of these things might produce some kind of an effect.
I appreciate that take. That's well phrased.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've often thought about with that darkness period is that the trichomes are sort of a protection from the sun, a protection from the light. At least that's one of the functions that they serve. And the cannabinoids themselves are degraded under intense light. And that's why everybody tries to keep their harvest in the dark, once it comes down. So while the plant's sort of alive, it's producing cannabinoids, and some of them are also sort of getting burned off by the light. And turning that light off sort of reduces the burn off.
That's true.
The plant still has sort of some energy and it's not going to like suddenly curl up and die in 24 or 36 hour darkness. Now, I do, while we're talking about this, want to say that I don't recommend going much longer than that. I think you can start causing problems if you go much longer than that. But yeah, I mean, one day in the dark is fine.
I want, because you say that, and I'm sure it's true that if you just leave the plant in darkness and continue to grow it as normal, it'll probably express all sorts of weird traits. But I do want to say, in my experience, I have harvested, back in Eureka, I would harvest a huge room and like accidentally leave some lowers, for instance, and have them sit in the back of the shed with all the lights off for extended periods of time. And that's a very humid climate. I also just put
Now, let me just point out something.
Please.
You stripped a large plant with a large carbohydrate load of almost all of its flowers and left it with only a few.
Okay.
So you have a plant with a large store of energy and only a little bit of floral growth on it.
That makes a lot of sense.
That's not just trapping a plant in the darkness for a week, right? That's a different scenario than that I would expect to do a little bit better.
Okay. I appreciate that input. That makes a lot of sense. And then something really interesting was I had the infestation in the basement when I brought some veggies in, inside from outside. I ended up condemning them to death. I put the green beans in the freezing cold Chicago garage with the lights off. I put the green onions, freshly harvested, out to die in the garage. I was going to take care of it later, but I kind of just like, you know, you stick them out there, you forget about them a little bit. I come back, the parsley and the green onions had grown in the darkness extensively. Like, I harvested another round of green onions. And the green bean was still alive somehow. It slowly ended up dying. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm stunned at how long they go with no light. It's really, really crazy.
Yeah. I don't have, I mean, I'm sort of a little bit stunned by that. I wonder how, if the temperature played any role in it or sort of what their store of energy was. But that's what you sort of want to think about is where are the plants getting their carbohydrates from then if they're no longer getting them from the light.
Now, to be fair, I would have the little garage light on in there. I don't think that would make much of a difference.
No. Yeah, it's not going to do.
It was mostly in dark. And like I said, I snipped a whole nother round of green onions. I was like, this is fucking crazy. I ended up throwing them out. You know, I'm worried that there was still bugs in the soil, winterizing or whatever, overwintered.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyways, that's my little darkness grow story.
Yeah. So that and the flush, I mean, those are two things that I sort of agree. We don't have scientific evidence to suggest that they do work, but we don't have any reason to believe that they're sort of hugely problematic. They can be if you both the flush and darkness. I think if you overdo it, you can cause problems. But yeah, a reasonable flush and a reasonable dark period are both kind of the kind of fun things to play around.
Yeah, you'll never sell me on not flushing. I have experienced times when I had too salty of a soil and smoked flower from that. I know it's not what everyone says it is, the removals of the chemicals, but I'm with you, Coco. I think there's definitely something to that.
There's something, yeah. I mean, there could be some benefit. There's actually been some more research that has come out recently that sort of reconfirms that, you know, the nutrient loads don't change, that we're not sort of removing things from the flowers, but there's a real chance that we are affecting growth patterns by suddenly altering the nutrition and affecting the plant hormones, affecting sort of the way the plant has to work in different ways. So yeah, there can be effects. And I definitely think it's short-sighted to point to those studies that suggest that we're not actually sort of leaching salts out of the flowers to say that means that the flush doesn't work. That means that the flush doesn't do that, though.
Good point, man. Really,
you know, we
point.
Need to think about what it might be doing. And, it might not be doing much of anything at all. But it's another one of these things that I think has been at least shown not to be very harmful if you do it in moderation.
Absolutely. And I just think there are certain empirical truths that you experience and you have to kind of, I almost feel like that has to be the base of your foundation. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get off track into scientific semantics.
It's almost a real science. The radical science happens when you break down that box, right?
Sure.
Like the Copernican revolution or whatever. It's like, it's stepping outside of sort of the universe that you've taken, the way you've taken it to believe.
Right.
But it's only appropriate if you've been thinking about it wrong.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. Well, we're deep in this episode.
See how we do this, Jordan? We had a question to start this. Something we're talking about something entirely different.
Holy shit. No, that was good stuff, man. I think the listeners love that. But you're right. That's hilarious. I wouldn't have it any other way, Coco. That's what I'm saying.
We talk about this, everybody, like before we get on the show. It's like, okay, we're going to talk about this. And then the show starts, and then we immediately start talking about something.
Like, right away. Oh, I love it, man.
I think every episode, man. It's great.
Yeah,
I love it.
I love it. We are going to get to this question, though. Mr. Canna Grower submitted it. Shout out to Mr. Canna Grower. He's in the Slack chat. Join up in the Slack chat, everybody. We are going to make some changes. The Slack chat is going to become largely members only. This was one of the hardest decisions I had to make. I'll update you more on it later. I won't waste time here. But there will be a public channel. There will be a public contest. But many of the specific channels, all the specific channels, are going members only. New membership at patreon.com/growcast. That page goes live January 1st. Mr. Canna Grower in the Slack chat today, though, says, does anyone know if it's possible to reuse cocoa that had dry amendments added to it? And if so, how would I go about doing that? I usually have to hydrate and wash the cocoa outside, but now it's freezing cold and I really don't want to get frostbite on my hands. Should I just toss this cocoa, buy ready-to-go cocoa, and save the bricks for summertime? Thank you, Mr. Canna Grower, for your question. Dr. Coco, what do you think?
So the first thing that he mentioned was amended Coco Core. And I would have to know what it was amended with in order to sort of know how to reuse or recycle at least the amendment part of it. Sometimes when growers talk about amended Coco Core, they're referring to something like the Tuper product, which basically just has like forest products in it and other stuff for aeration. Other times when people are talking about amending Coco Core, they're putting like guano or other sort of fertilizer stuff
more
in
organic-y. Right. And then aren't there also dry salts that a lot of people are buying now?
Yeah, right. They could be amending it with fertilization with just sort of structural elements. If you're amending it with anything that's sort of providing fertilization, it's going to be tough. It would depend on what it was. So I don't think that could give sort of very specific advice about that. I will just sort of give one little shout out. I think if you are fertilizing in coco with dry amendments, it is actually easier to go the other route with fertigation. But
it's one of the benefits of coco, right? Is you don't have to worry about oversaturation. It's one of the reasons you would want to apply your nutrients through the feed, through the reservoir. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. It's a whole lot easier to manage.
Interesting.
When you amend into the media, you're sort of baked in, right? And what you got, you can top dress, you can do teas or things like that to try to correct imbalances. But it's particularly tough to affect toxicities, for example. So it's just a more difficult way, especially in a media like Coco, which is really well suited for fertigation.
Right.
That makes sense. It allows you just a whole lot more control over the fertilizers that your plants are exposed to. So in coco, you know, there's a common method for dry amending fertilizers in coco. And based on what I see in sort of, you know, online and in our community and elsewhere, people have, especially first growers, have much less than a 50% success rate with it. And then we have the high-frequency fertigation method that I lay out, and first-time growers have like nearly 100% success rate with it. So I think it's just a whole lot harder to fertilize with dry amendments. But I actually don't think that this is necessarily what this question is asking.
Wow.
I think he may be using a product more like the Tuper that just says amended with like forest products and other things. Amended even with perlite is sometimes, you know, considered or called an amendment.
So no nutritional value. And in that case, you would be able to wash it or do whatever you're going to explain the process. You would be able to reuse it.
You would. Yeah. And you'd be able to reuse the stuff that was amended with fertilizers too. You'd probably just wash out all the fertilizers during the recycling process.
And then replace them if you wanted to do it again.
Treat it like unfertilized coco at that point.
Exactly.
And I think that that's a fine route to take as well. So the basic steps when you're reusing coco core, either get it out sort of when it's reasonably fresh and beat it out of the roots from the last row. So you can just, and if your plants were pretty healthy, they will be really holding on to that core with the roots. Like you pull out the whole thing, it's one solid root ball, and you got to like punch it for half an hour to get all the core issues to drop out of there. Or you can let it dry out entirely and even sort of let it bake out. The roots will largely sort of disintegrate into the coco, and then you can rinse and reuse it that way. I always recommend re-rinsing the coco during the course of the grow, especially due to root action. The coco itself breaks down and the larger fibers will produce a lot of dust just by the act of the plant sort of growing through it. So we want to rinse out some of that dust, get back to sort of a better ratio of larger fibers. If it's amended with perlite, you can just rinse the perlite with the coco. If it's amended with other things, you could probably rinse those too, as long as they're sort of larger than the colander size. I recommend an eighth inch grid or a perforated colander. And he mentioned not wanting to do it outside. I certainly recommend doing all of this outside if it's like, you know, above freezing and you have a yard. But I don't have a yard. It's never sort of below freezing here, but I don't have a yard to do it outside in. So I do it in my bathtub. Now, I've had a lot of comments on my YouTube video about doing it in my bathtub. Numerous, I would say at this point, dozens of people have noted that I probably don't own my condo, because I wouldn't do this in a condo that I own or in a bathtub that I own. You know, I've done it a lot, actually, and it's never led to any sort of plumbing issues, but that is, you do sort of lose a bit of cocoa, and, you know, if you're rinsing other things like perlite and stuff, you'd lose a little bit of perlite, another step down the drain. But that might be something of a trade-off, as opposed to, you mentioned, going outside and freezing to death. It would be tough to sort of rinse and buffer cocoa outside in sub-freezing conditions, because it's a wet process that requires liquid water.
So what's the beef with the comments on YouTube and the plumbing? Is it the magnet? What's leaching out of the cocoa that's damaging the pipes?
No, they just think it's going to clog up physically, I think.
Oh, okay.
The perlite and the cocoa fibers going down the drain. I don't think that it's going to. I mean, it hasn't. I think that, like, you know, we get dirt on our bodies and shower.
I kind of call bullcrap on that.
Human hair. It's sort of human hair is what, some of that.
Human hair is what clogs up those drains. Human hair starts forming a freaking net. And I've taken apart a bathroom or two. I'm no master tile man. I'm no master mason. I'm no master plumber. But I have unclogged plenty of drains, and I'll tell you, it's always fucking hair that ends up trapping all the other shit.
It's not perlite.
It's not perlite. No, surprisingly, I don't pull out perlite.
Can you even imagine like a perlite dam forming inside there? Having looked inside pipes,
I really can't. Sorry. Now I'm like, I'm taking a side on this one, but I gotta call bullcrap on that. And also, that's why I use liquid fire, because you gotta use liquid fire because it gets rid of the hair and then it doesn't clog up. You use the enzyme preventative from Zeps, you'll be fine. Okay, I'm a pipe expert. You got grime in your pipes, I know what to do. Perlite ain't the problem.
So do it in your bathtub would be my advice there.
Definitely an option. If you don't want to freeze your ass.
Don't come to me. Don't send me your plumbing bill, though. Send it to Jordan, because Jordan's the one that said that it would be A-okay on the plumbing.
Exactly. Now I'm going to give you a disclaimer saying, please don't take my advice at face value and consult the plumber. No,
this show is for information or for educational and entertainment purposes. Right?
Exactly. 100%. You got to have that. I should really have that disclaimer at the beginning. Before we return to the good doctor, got to give some love to Diamond Cut Co., the best scissors around. DiamondCutCo.com. Promo code GROWCAST saves you 15%, baby. Diamond Cut Co. Made for growers by growers, with ergonomic designs, super, super sharp, long lasting blades. I like how short the traditional kind of trimming scissor blades are. They have a whole bunch, by the way. I shouldn't just say how short the blades are, because they have a whole bunch of different kinds, different styles. One's for manicuring little buds, one's with dull tips, one's with sharp tips, spring-loaded, non-spring-loaded. If you need scissors, you need to go to DiamondCutCo.com. Promo code GROWCAST for 15% off. They're also super, super stylish. They're definitely the most aesthetically pleasing. And they're always very generous with their giveaway. So thank you, Diamond Cut Co. Make sure to use code GROWCAST, everybody. All right, let's get back to Dr. Coco. I did want to highlight one other thing, though, which is one of the big benefits of cocoa, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it is incredibly renewable and sustainable. If there was a reason you, like, if for some reason you had some organic stuff that you didn't want to rinse out and you were considering getting rid of the cocoa and buying some new stuff, if you could just take that used cocoa and incorporate it into your yard or something and then buy new cocoa.
I do that.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
I don't have a yard. I bring it down to my parents. I actually bring them every time I go and visit my parents. I haven't been there in over a year now, Al, since last Christmas, right? So about a year. But every time I go down there, I bring them a bunch of cocoa that sort of has been cycled through usually a couple of times. And then I bring them a bunch of runoff water. They'll use the runoff water for their
delightful Christmas gifts you have there.
Yeah, isn't it lovely? But yeah, they use the cocoa as just like a ground fill and an amendment around their gardens outside and their plants and their planters and stuff like that. Cocoa is a wonderful amendment for all of those purposes. It holds onto a lot of water.
But my point is you can buy more without feeling bad. You don't want to be doing stuff like with peat, like throwing away peat. getting rid of peat and then rebuying all the, like, cocoa is extraordinarily sustainable, right? Because it comes from coconut.
Comes from coconuts. Yeah, right. We grow it. You know, and people are now growing cocoa for growing coconuts for the purpose of making cocoa coir.
That's cool.
But it's also largely a byproduct of other uses of coconuts.
That's killer.
And so it's far more renewable than peat is for that reason. It's also really reusable. And you can continue to reuse. So the process is you want to, it's kind of a, to really reset it. And when we're growing indoor cannabis, I really want to be growing in like the ideal media, right? So I'm going to go through a few sort of extra steps that nobody would do if they were just doing this in a planter outside or whatever, but they're going to, if you're taking your cocoa from your cannabis grow and putting it into your outdoor garden or something, just put it out there, basically. You don't need to do much to it to prepare it for that. But if you want to reuse it for your cannabis crop and you want to get sort of back, reset it to the ideal medium, you want to rinse it out again to rinse away the peat. So usually in a colander that or in some sort of sieve, some sort of screen that allows the dust-sized particles to be rinsed away and holds on to the larger fiber particles. You don't need to rinse out all of the dust, but you should just sort of rinse it out to let the excess dust rinse out. And then you want to rebuffer it, which is just soaking it again in CalMag solution, a strong calcium magnesium solution.
You got videos on all of that on your YouTube page. So.
Yeah. I've got videos for this exact process, the rinsing and reusing cocoa coir. And, you know, at that point, it's just as good as it was to begin with, essentially. Eventually, if you keep doing this, you'll end up, you know, you'll rinse it all away because you lose a little bit every time you rinse it, right? Some of that peat disappears. But you can keep doing that, like, literally until the cocoa is gone. What actually ends up happening in practice is you lose cocoa faster than you lose perlite. So you just sort of add more fresh cocoa to this sort of recycled blend that's sort of really heavy in perlite. And you can basically just keep going with that forever.
That's interesting. So that's a reason to not throw it out. That's very interesting.
Yeah, you don't need to throw it out. The cocoa companies, almost all of them tell you like, oh, you only use it once. The cation exchange issues have become very bad.
They want you to buy more.
And trying to sell product, people. So yeah. I've been doing this for a while. I'm like, you know, a lot of people that have followed this and we all have really good success. Now, if you don't follow that process, if you try to cut corners on recycling your cocoa coir, you can kill your seedlings.
Okay, right.
And I've done that. I've had really good growers in my forum that.
So
go through the process, take the time and rinse it down and rebuffer it and it'll be fine.
Yeah. Are you confident in doing it? Follow the videos, do. And the good news is if for some reason you aren't confident and you just decide to switch or it goes wrong, whatever it may be, you don't have to feel bad about that because cocoa is in fact not it's very renewable.
Yeah. It's not mined product. Like they're mining.
It's not detrimental to the earth.
Yeah.
You know, even mines
have a pretty significant environmental impact just on that process.
Yeah, Mary Beth freaked me out about salts and like how that works and all that. So I don't know. I think cocoa is a great option. And now with all the organic, what do you think about using a liquid organic in cocoa? Like a nectar? Does anyone in your groups use the nectar for the gods? I'm a big fan of the foop. That stuff is very organic though.
Yeah, I mean, there are issues with it in terms of automation, which is one of the other topics we were thinking about getting into today. Mixed success. The Go Box, the General Organics, the General Hydroponics Organics line seems to work reasonably well. You know, we had a good grower try the Kyle Cushman's product and really struggle with it mightily. Hmm. And if you're interested in that, I would recommend getting in really looking at the sourcing of those products too, especially if you're doing this for, you know, environmental sensitivity reasons. You know, there's two basic reasons that people try to go organic. One of them is that they want to minimize their impact on the planet. The other is because they believe that it's a healthier product for them to consume. So if your interest in going organic is because if you want to minimize the impact on the planet, then I'd really recommend that that you not just take the organic label as meaning lower impact on the planet, because some of those products have a pretty significant impact on the planet in order to sort of manufacture and produce. Well,
that's true.
Especially the sources of nitrogen.
Well, that's one of the reasons I would like, I hope that the FOOP would fall into the better category there, because it is in fact fish derived. But yeah, Mary Beth is always coming on saying, don't use this organic product for this reason or that reason. And I'm always like, damn.
Yeah.
So that is a good point. But you left out something, Coco. Maybe the main reason that I grow organic is the end product, man, the flavors, and I'm selfish that way.
Well, that's what I mean by when I say that you think it's a better sort of quality or healthier product for you.
I thought I missed that. Okay, right on. Yeah, so, yeah, but, and I do think it is healthier, probably.
That's one of the reasons. So, but I completely discount that with cannabis. I mean, I don't, and certainly if we think about the science behind that, there's sort of zero science that suggests that it's a better quality product based on sources of fertilization.
I don't care about I'm going back to the empirical data, man. I am absolutely hooked, but that's just me. I know everybody has a different cannabis experience.
Well, but you know, I like to specifically push back on that one because it's a common one that you hear a lot of people sort of propagating. And I think it's largely a myth. And so like other bro science myths, I like to push back on this idea that it's a higher quality product based on the source of fertilization. You know, in agriculture, like in apples, I believe that you do get a higher quality product because they're not spraying organic apples with some of the really nasty fungicides and pesticides that they use in conventional apples. But that's the reason that apples that are organic are healthier and sort of better quality than apples that are not organic. It's not because of the way that the apples are fertilized.
So I actually do a lot of study on the Coffee Health and Science podcast, and yeah. I would actually maybe there's an episode with a Harvard medical doctor who is basically saying we're finding out that organic products are better for you because of the regenerative farming. I'm not saying these. You should go back and listen to the episode. He said there's some studies to indicate that it's not just the lack of pesticides. I don't know exactly what he was referring to, but I will. I got to ask you this on the cannabis side. You've smoked Super Soil, really good high quality organic. Do you notice a difference between synthetics in the experience?
No. I mean, first of all, we know that there doesn't because you can set up a double blind taste test, essentially, like the Pepsi experiment, Jordan, and none of your friends will be able to successfully identify which one was organic.
Oh my
and
God.
Which one was not.
I will set up this challenge. It's funny because our good buddy down in Aurora.
Our pre-analytic visions are so strong. So strain makes a big difference. Terpene profile makes a huge difference. And we'll notice some of that stuff.
Just the bud structure. You can look at the same strain. So our buddy in Aurora just grew out a bunch of cuts from the Great Rhizo Rich. So yeah. we literally have this experiment right in front of us. And you can just tell by looking at I don't need to taste it. You're right, it would have to be blindfolded. It would have to be blindfolded because I can tell you which buds are organic just by looking at it. Do you discount that?
Only if you already were introduced to them, though, Jordan, because I could show you other strains from other growers where the really nice looking one was the one grown with synthetics and the other one wasn't.
I'm not saying that they don't look nice.
The problem with all of those direct comparisons, though.
But what about, why does all dispo weed look similar? You know the shape I'm talking about, right? The hardened, I don't know. Maybe it's a lot of different things in the HPS
PGRs.
Lights. The PGRs.
PGR finishers, even just heavy kelp extract, I do believe that there are stuff like that done for aesthetic purposes for sale.
And those are common in the salt nutrient. Like most lines, if you're using a complete line, probably has a product. Is that fair to say?
You know, the PGR that I'm almost most concerned about, especially late in flower, is kelp.
Oh, wow. Really? You mean the tricantinol?
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. It's not. It's a product of our biases to think that the danger exactly lines up with what we call synthetic versus organic.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It doesn't. Those categories don't mean exactly what we think they mean. And they're used as a shorthand for just a whole host of things. And it becomes very sloppy thinking.
True. And so, and there's plenty of organic things that are bad for
you. From a scientific standpoint, Yeah, I just wanted to recommend that you become really, you understand why you want what it is that you think you're wanting and what aspects of these things. It's like, to be certified organic is just sort of a ridiculous thing. It doesn't line up with anybody's exact sort of analytic vision of what organic should mean. So there's lots of different kinds of definitions, and I'm not undercutting sort of the goals that you have. I understand the goal of reducing the impact on the planet. I share that goal. I understand the goal of wanting to grow sort of clean and healthy cannabis or other crops. And I share that goal as well. I think that we just need to understand sort of how our different practices and how things that are organic or not contribute to those different goals.
I totally agree. And I think we're going to have to, this is why I love you, Dr. Coco, because we can have these conversations and I feel like we can actually work through them without like attacking each other. But we are going to have to agree to disagree, because I truly, and this is coming as a free thinking person, not just as someone who has an organic bias. I used to be anti-organic. I used to think it was a scam and all that. But especially after working with coffee, I believe that coffee is no different than cannabis, no different than the other top organic must buys that I have. I think that it is a more robust and specifically flavorful and aromatic product. And I will definitely be taking this these two sample cuts. I'm really interested to see how Rizo Rich's cuts, which have a whole lineage in organic soil, and then did very, very well in a synthetic setup. Excellent yielding. But I will get Rizo Rich on. The products are just a little bit different, man. A little bit different. But we'll see.
I'm not doubting that they're different, Jordan. And I'm not doubting that you would be able to perceive a difference as a consumer. However, I mean, you know, we'd have to set up the actual double-blind experience.
We would. And even that would be unfair, right?
I want to push that.
Even that double-blind wouldn't be perfectly accurate. That's fair to say, too, right? There's so many variables.
No, what you would be able to see is that people could not consistently identify which one was which. People like, such as yourself, that are adamant aficionados of only organic flower, would end up saying at least half of the time that you thought the conventional one was better than the organic one. And you would be convinced on some of these that this one was organic and that one was conventional, and you'd be wrong.
I think that if you got high quality, really high quality synthetic, I think you're probably right. My thing is that you kind of like you end up lumping these into categories. Like I said, the Dispo is like classic synthetic, you know what I mean? But all that being said, I would take you up on that challenge. I'm not sure I would succeed.
Dispensary weed to homegrown organic weed, then our homegrown's gonna win.
Yeah, no matter what this is. That's what I'm saying.
That's not a fair comparison.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm pointing out.
So. You know, we deal with this all the time, and I just want to make sure that people hear the other opinion. And my opinion certainly is that the you can grow absolutely top quality flavorful cannabis in a conventional or in an organic setup.
Of course you can.
And I don't honestly believe that if you were blind, you would not, even if you could see it, but you didn't know. And I just presented you with two strains of marijuana. Things like the terpene profile, the strain, even stuff about the way it was dried and cured may create perceptible differences between them, but you wouldn't be able to reliably tell me which one was which.
No, you're right. If it were strains that I've never tried and it was high quality, flavorful synthetic versus high quality, flavorful organic, and I had to discern. Absolutely not.
Because it's the same strain.
No, that's true. Right. I will agree with that. Absolutely. But I do think that they come out different, and I would like to see dig into the reasons why, right? Why they come out different.
These double blind taste tests, and they do something like, okay, tell me which one of these strawberry yogurts tastes the most strawberry. And they give the two vanilla yogurt samples to people, and the people will be talking about, oh, sample B has much better strawberry profile than I taste the strawberry right away. It's like the power of suggestion is so incredible.
Yeah.
The power of your pre-analytic ideas about what you think is better and why you think it's better determine your experience at least as much as the objective experience, the objective reality of the experience.
I would, there's definitely a ton of truth to that, but I also wouldn't discount You know, I think there is a difference between the average person who has a Wednesday off to go do some yogurt study and, for instance, like the cop and like, and I'm serious. And for instance,
that's a real one. I've seen that one where they're giving them vanilla yogurt and asking them which of these strawberry yogurts taste the most strawberry. And person after person is going on in detail about how they really like the strawberry flavor of this one and stuff. I mean, it's incredible.
Never underestimate the stupidity of your average. But again, back to the coffee people. I do know coffee connoisseurs who can do what you're describing, right? So I do think that
there's been tests like that done with sommeliers, though. The people that taste wine, and I'm trying to get them to identify the $200 bottle of wine versus the $2 bottle of wine, and they can't even do it successfully.
I know. I've literally seen it done before my eyes with coffee. I know that there are tests that have been done where people weren't able to do it, and maybe wine is different. But I wouldn't just place it like, hey, there's no way to tell
specific profiles.
Absolutely, man. So, and I've literally seen it done before my eyes with multitudes of coffees and a coffee, again, a coffee expert.
My message here is just that if you want to enjoy whatever it is that you're consuming more, you have to believe that you're going to enjoy consuming it more. And if you believe that it being a specific kind of coffee, that's going to lead you to enjoy it more, then you'll pick up on that flavor and it will actually lead to that.
But
experience.
Also, man, don't let that color your vision. Cause I'm telling you as an objective thinker, I tried Rizo Rich's weed. It was the best weed I've ever smoked. I replicated his style. So also don't overthink it. Like I'm some sort of confirmation, but like those are all objective. He grows the best weed I've ever smoked. I emulated his style and I'm never going back. So it's like, I get what you're saying, but
that is confirm. I mean, that's exactly what confirmation bias is, Jordan. Finding something that you want and then trying to prove that it's the best. I mean, that's confirming what you already believe.
No, I was presented with a product that was better and I was like, wow, this is the best I've ever smoked. I'm going to emulate this guy's style, and I'm happy with how it turned out. So maybe there is confirmation bias after, but it didn't start with
that's,
like...
That's just, it's not bad. Confirmation bias isn't always bad. It's actually the way that you should approach life as a gardener.
Yeah, pattern making.
Try to find the way that you think it's going to work
best. Pattern making brands.
You know, far too many people probably do would try to approach their grows as scientists and running like little experiments and stuff like that. And I actually think that we can't gain much from that because our sample sizes are so small and we end up drawing.
That's what I was saying before, right? You can't even really, with all the microclimates, like we can do split tests as best we can, but it's really, there are so many factors in growing that what is real objective science in the garden?
Yeah. Well, that's just an annoying one for somebody that grows conventionally. Every organic grower is like, oh yeah, but my weed's better, man. And it's like, dude, it's just an annoying thing to have to deal with all the time when I don't believe it's true.
There are organic snobs. There are organic snobs out there. And I'm going to apologize on behalf of them to you right now, Coco.
Yeah.
In fact, so much so that like when I was a synthetic grower, there were some people who literally wouldn't share their knowledge with me because they knew I was a synthetic grower, even though it was like piquing my interest, you know? And they were like, oh, like, no, you're one of those salt growers. Like, you don't need to know that was literally what he said. And I remember just being like, all right, thanks, Dick. And by the way, I still went down an organic path that just set me back 4 or 5 years. So I totally get the organosnob attitude. And I think you see it in all sides of everything. But I do want to apologize for any organosnobs and all organosnobs out there, because us organic growers, we can get snobby. It's just... it's part of it, man.
No,
I'm just playing around, but
it feels like it wouldn't have to be part of it.
That's just a joke. It's,
yeah. Well, it is, there's that underlying idea of being sort of justified by being correct. But again, I really advocate for organic agriculture on a large scale, on sort of all outdoor agriculture. People are often sort of surprised by that.
For other reasons. Yeah.
I really personally believe, and I've tried to advocate this a lot, that it is almost sort of borderline irresponsible to do some of the things that we do in indoor agriculture. I think that some people take a really environmentally irresponsible approach to the way that they grow, and they just don't care. And I think that to some extent, that gives a lot of people that aren't organic cannabis growers sort of the impression that, like, if you cared about the environment or something, that you would do it organically. that's sort of the point that I always find myself pushing back.
Well, I mean, it's more about responsible gardening. And it's interesting you said, okay, so I really don't want to go off on certification, but you're right. Organic certification is different in all sorts of different sectors. It's about responsible gardening. Now, in coffee, they actually do a really good job with organic. Like, if you get an organic coffee, it checks a lot of boxes. It's not just like pesticide free. It's about the storage. It's about the shipping. It's about a whole bunch of stuff. There are other areas where it's not like that, where you think you're doing a good job because it says this certification, that certification, organic certified, fair trade, and it's absolutely not. So it's more about responsible farming. I think this was one of the most friendly and spirited synthetic versus organic discussions that I've heard out there. And why I like doing this is because now the listeners are going to form their own opinions, and I don't want hate on either side. Like, I feel like this is a good role model between us, Dr. Coco, because we love you here, and we're really big on organic practices. That's a big part of both my shows, and it's just cool that we can have this discussion openly and honestly without the negativity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I try never to have the negativity, and I'm almost always sort of like shocked by it. I'm like, oh, we're gonna play like that, huh? Like, okay.
Dude, they get after it on pages and stuff. I mean, they'll just comment shitty stuff for any opinion. So for us to be able to talk this out for like 20, 30 minutes and just have a friendly discussion about it, I think is really dope and good for the listeners who, like I said, will walk away forming their own opinions.
Yeah, as it should be.
I absolutely agree. We were supposed to talk about stuff, man.
Yeah, what else do we have? What else we got?
We got to talk wet trim and dry trim on the next episode. Let's make a little bit more time here. I'm gonna postpone my next appointment here.
I was just going to try to tease it a little bit.
No, yeah, we got to go 10 minutes or so longer here because I need to say it. When I talk to people about what's your optimal trimming process, dry trim comes up the vast majority of the time. So for you to come up and then provide some like real data as to why wet trimming might be better.
No, I'm really curious. Are these small scale home growers or are these sort of larger medium scale growers?
I mean, if I had to say, I'd probably say more small scale, but it's like across the board, it seems like dry trimming is a little bit more common. There's the like preliminary wet trim, but I don't know about size specifically. So what are you saying?
Let me put this out there. Dry trimming is a whole hell of a lot easier.
Right.
It's easier to do it with machines. I mean, it's possible to do it with machines to dry trim or to dry trim in trim bags or to dry trim in other things like that. The leaves essentially like sort of break off with your hand if the plant is properly dried. Wet trimming is harder. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
The reason that wet trimming sticks around, there's got to be something to it. If it was actually worse, everybody would dry trim. So, you know, the really quick sort of analysis, you can trim much closer with a wet trim. And, you know, there's other benefits to it too, that you actually get to do stuff with the trim. You get more trim to do stuff like make edibles or make extracts or other things. But yeah, I find that you can get a much tighter trim, end up with a much sort of better finished product in the end too. And it helps the dry. There's a lot of issues though. You need to be aware of your climate, about how fast things are going to dry, about how you're going to sort of hold it in a cure for a while. All of those things. So it'll be an interesting talk, and I'll go through it in the meantime and come fresh from my experience with it next time we have our chat.
But maybe just a little bit of a tease, like what, as for there, I believe you talked about chlorophyll and how chlorophyll reacts during the wet trimming. Like, can you maybe elaborate on that?
Well, you're removing most of it. I mean, that's sort of the main reason that we want to remove the leaves. There's sort of a lot of carbon in there. But the chlorophyll is one of the chemicals that's going to create that grassy smell. It creates a sort of unsatisfying experience for cannabis consumers. And so one of the things that happens during the dry, and especially during the what we call the cure process, is sort of the breakdown and the degradation of some of those plant compounds. When you trim, you're physically removing the sort of largest sink of chlorophyll in the plant.
That would otherwise, what, disperse? Like, Because you know you trim that off anyways once it dries. But does the chlorophyll kind of like even out throughout the bud? You know what I mean? It's a stupid question.
You mean by just leaving it on the plant?
Yeah, because I mean, you say that the biggest bank of chlorophyll is the leaf. You cut that off anyways.
If you let the buds dry, they will encase a lot of the leaf that I would have trimmed out wet.
Okay.
So the flowers are more pliable, more workable. You can get the leaves out of the buds.
It kind of shrinks.
I trim really close.
Yeah. Okay. I feel you.
When you dry trim, the buds kind of harden up. You know what I mean? And especially like the top colas where there's like a big sort of bud there. And you know, if you're breaking that apart to smoke it later, there's like half a leaf sort of stuck in there or whatever. All those bits and pieces or just what they call the crow's feet. Sort of down at the bottom of the buds.
Right. Yeah, the little sticks and stems.
The issue that I want to say is if you've never wet trimmed before and you want to try it, it dramatically speeds up the dry process. And you need to be, so some growers can get themselves into trouble if they wet trim and then try to dry it like they've dried cannabis or try to just dry it too long. Almost everything that I hear about drying timelines is really for a dry trim plant.
Right.
And so you got to be aware that it's going to dry faster than that. I think that's a benefit for a lot of people because those initial couple of days of drying is where you're fighting with the potential for mold. Everybody always says dry slow, you know, the slower the better. I actually think getting out of the danger zone for mold quickly is a good idea.
Yeah, that's
dramatically slowing the dry. You don't want to dry quickly until it's like 10% or something, right? But you do kind of want that initial dry period to go pretty quick because you don't want to leave them with a ton of moisture, just sort of fat, fluffy, juicy flowers that are susceptible to getting mold.
So you're talking about adjusting the RH percentage. You probably still like a cool grow, but in the early stages, maybe bump it down to what, 50%? And then maybe go up higher into the 55 range, or if you're like a 60-60 guy.
It totally depends on if you dry trim or wet trim. So if you're wet trim and you're drying now flower clusters that have already been really well trimmed, you can be at a higher relative humidity because the leaves aren't sort of holding any moisture in the plant. And no matter what your relative humidity is, you're probably going to dry faster than you would have if you had wet trim.
Right. Right. That makes
sense. So some people just think that I need to dry slow and the dry trim helps me dry slower by leaving those leaves. It slows down the dry.
Okay.
I don't think that's the part that you want to slow down. I think the part you want to slow down is essentially once the plants get to that cure zone, like around 60% relative humidity, if you put them in a jar. That is the point you want to like essentially stop the dry process and hold them at that state for a long time. But drying them down, you know, if you put your plants, when you first cut them down into a jar, the relative humidity would be like 99%, right? You want to get them from that position down to where the relative humidity would be 60%, I think in a couple few days to mitigate the risk of mold. I don't think there's any negative sort of taste or potency effects as long as you stop drying at that point and hold them at that sort of 60 to 65% relative humidity.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And don't you feel that oftentimes it's a issue of airflow within the tent? Like I really like to get that air moving in the tent to prevent that mold, because even if you're a little below 60%, if it's stagnant, if there's leaves poking on each other, if you haven't done a wet trim, like that's, you're just asking for mold at that point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But all of those things you have to keep, you got to kind of balance everything. And so to give good trimming and drying advice, you need to know the physical condition. Are they drying in a trim or like in an open closet? What's the relative humidity? What's the temperature? How much airflow is there? How big are the buds? How much did you break down the plant during the initial sort of harvesting process? Did you break it down at all, or is like the whole plant, you know, hanging upside down by its roots? All of those factors contribute to how long it's going to dry and, you know, even specific guidance that I would give about raising or lowering the temperature to the relative humidity. So, to be aware of all of that.
Yeah, it is quite a balancing act, especially because you put the dehumidifier in there and now you're adding heat. So you got to control your heat. Sometimes it's a good idea to put the humidifier outside of the space, maybe next to the intake. But like you're right, it is a bit of a formula, if you will.
And it depends. I've never had to use a dehumidifier because we have a dry enough climate. I'm actually sometimes tempted to use a humidifier.
That was going
to
be my next question. What if it's too dry?
Yeah, but at that point, I mean, my strategy has evolved a little bit through the years. But I essentially dry pretty quick now. I wet trim. I dry the buds pretty quick. I try to get them into jars and get them stabilized in jars. And then I hold them at a stable relative humidity and temperature for a long time. Now it's gotten longer and longer because I sort of go through them in order. But yeah, like at least a 60-day cure, 21 days at that point is usually fine, like 3 weeks. But that's sort of evolved. I don't really worry about slowing down the dry while they're outside of the jars anymore. So I would never be concerned about the sort of humidifying the drying space. I think the biggest trick there is to just not let them get over dry. It's okay to get down to that relative humidity or that moisture content quickly, I think.
I am a little concerned about that, to be honest.
If you keep dropping well below that.
Right. And you definitely don't want to couple any additional dryness with heat would be my suggestion. But I'm a little bit concerned about that because my basement in the winter is crazy dry. We're talking below, how dry is it out there in LA?
It can get pretty dry. I mean, sometimes the room where the plants are drying is like below 50%, like in the mid 40s.
Yeah, I got down to like 38%.
And I'll dry them in 3 days.
Wow, that's crazy. I've never had that issue because back in Humboldt, it was always fighting the humidity. And I was wondering, maybe I should just I'm thinking ambient humidity because what you don't want is a humidifier blowing moisture on your buds. You know what I mean?
No, you definitely don't want a humidifier blowing moisture on your buds. But that's my whole point. I think that in that situation, what I would recommend is let them dry there. Just get them into jars as soon as, they're going to be ready. It's tough to know that for new growers. I haven't found any of these little guidelines that people talk about, like the littlest bud should pull off without pulling a string or the stem should snap. In my opinion, all of those things happen after it's too dry. Like if you get to that point, it's already too dry. So it's like before the buds pull off and don't pull a string or before they really snap when you break the smallest branches. The best way to judge that, I would say, for home growers is to cut off a bunch of the smaller buds, put them in a jar and see where you're at. Give it a couple hours, see what the relative humidity is in that jar, and then make the determination about, should I get the rest of these in the jar as fast as possible or should I get these back out or sort of where you're at with that. But as long as I think you arrest the drying process before it goes too far, you're not going to have problems with it.
That's a good insight because I do think people worry about that. I also want to say we do have to run here.
It's safer, right? Because you're getting out of that mold zone faster. So I really think that, putting a humidifier to slow down that initial dry where you're in the mold zone already, that just is a recipe, I think, for disaster more than a better dry or a better cure.
And don't you feel you kind of at a certain point have to succumb to your local environment? Like if you're in the arid, if you're in an arid Colorado grow and you're just not going to achieve that humble sticky icky that's so sticky it doesn't even quite burn right in a joint. Like you do have to succumb to your local environment at a certain point to a degree, right?
Yeah, I agree. We try to artificially create the exact set of drying conditions. But again, I really think that you can do a lot of that stuff in jars or in a sealed container later. Incidentally, and I've asked this quite a bit, I do think that the quart-sized jars are like the ideal curing environment.
You've said that before. When they get too big, it's not quite the same. I have noticed that.
Yeah. when they get too big, it's tougher to stabilize at the right sort of relative humidity.
So tiny.
And it's tougher to sort of make sure everything in the area is all exactly going to be the same. I mean, it will eventually in a jar anyways, but yeah, a small jar, they're really easy to work with. They're really easy to set at the right sort of relative humidity. And it's something that no commercial grow op is ever going to mess with. They're not even going to seal it up at any point. And at point, they're just going to slow down the dry. In an open room, they just slow down the dry until it's no longer sort of drying and stabilized at whatever relative humidity. I think that we gain a lot from the small batch sort of drying and curing process, in that the attention to sort of those much smaller batches gives us it's one of the main reasons I think that homegrown is much better than dispensary made.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Man, I would love for you to, I would love to like do an episode and just talk to you about the dispose out here and the craziness. Like, we always focus on growing, and rightfully so. We love talking about grow science, but there's some stuff.
It's been a while since I've been to a dispensary, man. I used to frequent them fairly regularly. Pretty much since California went recreational and the prices all got jacked up, and like, it just wasn't fun anymore.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it really, they screwed the medical consumers here quite a bit during that rollout. I was already growing at that point, of course, but yeah, it just stopped any sort of motivation to go and check out dispensary stuff.
That's exactly what happened here, is they definitely screwed medical patients, and they were talking about implementing a system where police have a record of every piece of cannabis purchased, and it's like in the local police records. And it's nuts out here, dude. Unfortunately, we don't have time to discuss it right now, but come back soon, right, Dr. Coco? We'll do another one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, if I don't come back before the holidays and the new year and all of that, I hope that everything goes well with your big January 1st launch. I hope everybody comes and joins us in the New Year's Grow Challenge. And I hope everybody has a wonderful and safe holidays. Stay safe out there, everyone.
And remember, we're giving away a year of new GrowCast membership for the Cocoa for Cannabis Challenge. So look forward to that.
Yes, one of our big prizes. We're going to do that on the January 1st, sort of the kickoff. It'll be the kickoff for the GrowCast membership too. So yeah, everybody get in on this thing. It's free to join the New Year's Grow Challenge. There's lots of fun. You can grow with Jordan and I and hundreds of other people. So head on over to cocoaforcannabis.com/challenge and sign up.
All right, everybody. That's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. This is Dr. Coco and Jordan River signing off, saying be safe and grow smarter.
Grower love, everyone.
That's our show for today, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. I appreciate each and every one of you. New membership is opening January 1st. That's right. Patreon is our new host to membership. You're going to be hearing all about it. You members already know about it, but stay tuned. We got huge things in the work. Just remember, January 1st, new membership launches. Quick shout out to Illinois Cannabis Consulting, Rich's consulting company. Go get some consulting from Rizo Rich. I also want to remind you guys who might be fretting over a holiday present, you probably still got time upon hearing this, of getting some Purity Coffee. PurityCoffee.com is a great, great Christmas present. Organic, consciously crafted coffee. Use code RIVER for 20% off, everybody. And finally, shout out to Jay Blanked for doing the beat for the ads. That's all for today, everyone. Thank you so much. Best of luck in your gardens. Appreciate you all. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.